Well, good morning, church, and it's a pleasure to be together and to be able to talk about things that are part of this thing called the journey. It's a label that we've given to a sermon series that probably describes your life. You know, I was at a grocery store yesterday and bumped into a great friend of mine, and we just said hello. And he was busy working in his yard, and I was just, I don't know, grazing for snacks at this grocery store because I was out on a walk and I needed some fuel. But there's just, we did Saturday. How many of you just yesterday did Saturday? Whatever that. How many of, does that include cleanup, wash it, it's just stuff, right? It's part of the day-to-day of living. But sometimes we make a mistake and we think that the church is a place where sacred things happen. But what happens maybe Sunday afternoon to the next Sunday morning becomes sort of about your job and school and, you know, a lesser thing. And I'm not convinced that's the case. I'm convinced, in fact, just the opposite, that God wants to have, as Paul said in Colossians 1, because Jesus deserves it, he wants to have first place in everything. That means tomorrow morning when you go to work. That means, for my one of our children still in college, that means midterms, or I guess it's close to finals. The push is on, you know. Jesus is there, wants to be first place. And that's true of everything you and I just prayed about. So if you're new to Grace Point, there's a word in our name, grace, that actually formed the title of today's message and today's sort of probe and consideration about this journey with Jesus. What would we have noticed? What would we have experienced? And we're going to go into one of my favorite parables to learn some things. Let me just say a word about my very obvious beard this morning. I was going to tell you a funny comment somebody made that when they were dating years ago, that if a boy came to the house shaved like that, he wouldn't open the door. So there you have it. In a generation past, that might have been the way it went. My kids, and to some extent, Debbie thinks I'm handsome with it. So anyway, that's the story. There you go. There's the personal life of Steve. So, all right, let me tell you about a story that's going to rock you. Philip Yancey tells about a friend who worked with the down and outs, the street people of Chicago. And he described one day when this man did to Philip, when a prostitute came to him desperate for help. He, of course, was hurting badly. She was homeless, lived on the streets, and hooked on street drugs. She was very much in failing health, and at every level was incapable of basic functioning, much less of caring for her 2-year-old daughter. As she described her situation, the man listening to it was stunned and silent. And after a long silence, mostly at a loss of what to say, he broke the awkwardness by asking if she had ever thought of going to a church for help. And here's how he described her reaction. Quote, "I will never forget the look of pure astonishment that crossed her face." Church? Came the wrinkled look and bitter words from her lips. Church, she cried, why would I ever go there? They just make me feel even worse than I already do. I don't for a minute think that she was describing every church. And I'm certain she's not describing our church. But what bothers me is the thought that she could possibly be describing any church. That should bother all of us. In stark contrast to some churches, evidently, which specialize in making broken people feel worse than they already do. And by the way, can I add, guarantee they won't come back. Jesus was known as a friend of sinners. Now just take that in for a second and digest the contrast. How can I say that? Because the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, report that great numbers, not a few, but great numbers actually ran to Jesus. And we're told in lots of places something of a distinction of these great numbers. They were sinners, the Bible tells us. And they ran to Jesus rather than running from Jesus. The Gospel of Mark calls attention to this fact by saying, while Jesus was having dinner with a man named Levi, his other known name is Matthew. He actually went on to become the writer of this gospel, but that was later in his life. At this point, he's known as one of these tax collectors and sinners. So the house is filled, Matthew's house, he gave the dinner party, is filled with his people, sinners and tax collectors. You getting the feel here? And Jesus was actually there having dinner with those people. For there were many who followed him. He's eating there with Matthew, and when the teachers of the law, who also looked on, who were Pharisees, saw him eating and spending this evening with sinners and tax collectors, they asked, not him, but his disciples, which reveals something about their, maybe their character. Perhaps they knew the expected answer. So they ask his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Have we lost that? Do sinners hang out with you? With us? 25 years ago, I stood in front of a little church in Tigard, Oregon, and I declared that, based on the gospel, the church was created to be a hospital for sinners, not a hotel for saints. You've been to nice hotels. Raise your hand if it's you couldn't afford it, but you stayed there anyway, okay? Really nice. Okay? That's a great feeling. No one messes you. The room's impeccable. Ever been in a room that the bed actually wasn't changed and you pulled the sheets back and went, oh, this won't work? That happened once. That was not good. Then I demanded the hotel, you know. I mean, we know what hotels are and we know what we expect when we go there. Clean, nice, neat. The Bible paints a different picture, thanks to Jesus, that it is, in fact, the church is not a hotel for comfortable people who don't want to get soiled. The hospital for really messed up people. I told more about that long ago, but I want to ask this question. Is that still true of us today? It was certainly true of Jesus in his day, and I guess put it out there. I believe with all my heart that you and I must be willing to become that if we've lost some of that, or risk as a church that people would say along with that prostitute in Chicago, Grace Point? Why would I ever go there? See how that story hit me? Why would I ever go there? They just make me feel even worse than I feel today. What was Jesus' secret? Known by everyone who ran to him for help. The sermon title today, it's the word grace. I want you to see it in a story Jesus told. It's in Luke chapter 18. If you haven't turned there already, would you do so? And it's in verse 9 through 14. It's a short story retold here by Luke. And it's known as a parable, which was taught by Jesus. A parable was a simple story. While you're turning there, I'll just tell you this, which illustrated a spiritual truth. It's much like how you feel when you're hearing a sermon like this, and then the pastor says, how many of you have ever stayed in a hotel that was, you know, that kind of thing? That's called an illustration. And Jesus used them frequently. Depending on how you count, 30 to 40 of them are recorded in the four Gospels. Okay? So he taught about them frequently, and it was fascinating because they were filled with a sense of, I get that. In fact, if you had been listening, you might have been squinting, wondering, oh, what's he saying? And then all of a sudden, wham, he would share a parable, and you'd go, oh, well, duh, I get that. That makes sense to me now. That was what a parable did. Most famous parable? Probably most would say Matthew 13 and the sower of the seed. And if you're not familiar with farming, you kind of go, huh? Then you find out Jesus explains the parable and says, you know what? The seed is sown. That is cast by a farmer. And he or she throws his seed, and the seed is the gospel. And it lands on different soils. We're told about four different soils, which in Jesus' illustration, they're people types. And they represent some people who hear the gospel, and it lands on them, and they go, wow, and that's about it. It's a quick flash and gone. That's one soil type. All the way over to the other extreme where it lands on a very fruit-bearing soil, and it raises up to be a bumper crop. And every one of us, I never lived on a farm, but you get it when you hear it. That would probably be most famous of his parables in Matthew 13. There's certainly a repeated theme also in Matthew 13. Eight times he talks about the kingdom of heaven using parables. Eight different parables are found in Matthew 13 talking, well, the kingdom of heaven is like, and then he tells a story. And you come away going, the kingdom of heaven was a fog in my mind, but now I get it. It makes more sense. My favorite, maybe you have a favorite, the prodigal son, Luke chapter 15. And read that later today just to, you know, see why I appreciate it so much. But it's actually a series of three quick parables, the lost coin, the lost sheep, and then the lost son. And the parable involving the son took up most of that time that Jesus was teaching there. Talks about just all kinds of cool things to explain the extent of God's patience towards lost people. And that son finally gives up on a crazy walk of life, and he decides, I'm way off the path, not sure how it's all going to turn out, but I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to my dad. I'm going to say, Dad, I messed up bad. You know, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Just make me like a servant. It beats feet and pigs where I've been. And this story is just, I read it, I've read it, I've shared it with people hundreds and hundreds of times. And almost never can I get through it without choking up. I just go, wow, what, you know, we can relate to the son, but the purpose of that story is to cause us to see the Father, to see who God is. When you mess up and go crazy, and he welcomes you back home. So here in Luke 18, Jesus is teaching about grace through a parable that involves two people praying. So look on with me. Let's read it. Verse 9, to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself. I'm going to slow down, let you visualize everything here. It's a short story. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like that tax collector over there in the corner. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So, there it is. And it's important for us to understand something of the identity of these two people, to really get the message, the meat of what Jesus is teaching. They're the two people in this that they play featured roles in the story Jesus tells. And if we understand them, we will not only get it, but we will leave here and say, I want to live that. Okay? So that's my mission in a couple of minutes. So let's start by the most surprising of the two people, and it has to be the tax collector. Remember, they both come into the temple to pray. The tax collector comes up actually second, but I'm starting with him in verse 13. He shows up in this parable. Tax collectors were the bane of nearly everyone living in Palestine, in the Jewish community. You said you were a tax collector, or if it was known, or you stood at the tax collecting station, you were the person people resented. How many of you are somewhere in the tax preparing season right now? Okay, you're working on your taxes? Okay, I just did that the last couple of days. Okay, don't think of Uncle Sam as a tax collector. Okay, because what you've been doing to work out your taxes is to do what? Pay more? Anybody want to pay more taxes? Just raise your hand and leave, okay? That's a dumb idea. Who would do that, right? Okay, but what are you doing? You're doing what I'm doing. I can't pay that much tax. We got to find a way to chip away at that and bring it down to much less, right? And here's the deal. You can do all that I just said legally or not. No, anyway, you get the idea? So, right? You do it, I do it. I'm supposed to pay that? Well, but what if I write off, you know, my boat and my Hawaiian home? And, no, just kidding. What if I write off and it brings it down? And the government, that's all part of the deal. It was not part of the deal in this day. If I'm a tax collector, I say, I'm gonna tax the wheelchair. I'm going to tax that home you live in, by a formula I just came up with. I'm going to tax that car. They would tax anything and everything. And you had no recourse. There was no way you could do anything about it. They had the force of law to back their exploitive methods of taxing anyone for anything. And resist them, and they would freely use force to exact the payment that they've demanded. And they had the backing of the ruling Romans to carry out punishment if you refuse. You getting the picture? These were, you know, people have teased, that's like the IRS today. No, it's not. Now, which is why, in the words I showed you earlier from Mark 2:16, the Pharisees asked, why do you eat and drink with such people? Why is this? To state the obvious, the sentiment of this day was that tax collectors don't belong in the temple. That was the understood. What in the world are you doing here, was the thought, if one was spotted in that setting. They didn't belong in the temple. Tax it? Sure. Attend it? Fat chance. Welcomed in it? Never. Now you're getting the feel. But here we're told that this tax collector was hurting. Did you see the pain? Sense it? He's hurting. He's not doing well. Upset, evidently, about something. And you know the prevailing attitude by most in that gathering that day? The prevailing attitude would have been, hey, please, take your troubles home with you. Neither you nor your problems are welcome in this place. You deserve it. You're hurting because you brought it on. An almost certainty that this was the first time this tax collector found himself in the temple, and it would likely be the last. We'll come back to the tax collector in just a moment, but next you're going to have no trouble noticing the other person who came into the temple and Jesus calls attention to on that day when he told this story. He's the Pharisee. And in contrast to the tax collector, he belonged here. This was home, sweet home. I belong here. He came daily. In fact, four times daily. Most likely, he was a Pharisee. It took religion to a much higher level than the masses. A card-carrying member, in fact, of the religious community. He would likely be recognized by everybody else gathered. We know him. Why do you know him? Because he's a standout guy. He's got it going. He's got it down. This was the sentiment of Pharisees in that day. He stood out as a person spiritually with it, and may I add, and he liked that. He gains our immediate notice in the story because Jesus calls attention to him. I want you to look back at these words, and let's notice about this Pharisee. Verse 11 starts. Notice some things again. He stood up quite aloof is the impression I have when I imagine him. He's standing up. He's not sitting like you. He's being noticed. But maybe like the look on my face where you pull back and condescend to a look to the others around you. You poor little people. Was undoubtedly the feeling as he stood there by himself. Notice his eyes aren't upward in awe. I'm not saying you have to have your eyes open or your hands raised in worship, but typically when you do, your eyes are upward for what reason? To notice the ceiling? In a place? Or to imagine the Savior. I do it that way. I raise my hands. I look heavenward in awe of a God that's watching all that's going on. Notice his eyes are not upward and they're not downward, which would be another look that might be very appropriate in church, in a temple like this. A downward look would be downcast, like I'm in dread. I know what I'm made of. I know I'm a sinful human. I know I messed up. I just feel almost conspicuously out of place here because I've got this secret. It's wrecking my soul. And I can't look up in awe because I'm inclined to just look down in dread, but he was doing neither of those. Notice his look is actually outward, verse 11 tells us. Outward in comparison. As he makes note of the fact, Jesus does, that this man is exceptional. He's very proud of his exceptionalism. And he lists off the people that he's better than. The lesser people around him, the particularly the likes of that tax cheat over there. That's the idea in verse 11. He didn't soil himself with the stuff that besets the rest. And he even, in case you're guessing what that is, a robber. That's a cheater. An evildoer and an adulterer. I don't do that stuff. He makes a point of. His attributes are exemplary. He fasts, we're told by Jesus, twice a week, which is double the expectation. And he gives a tenth of everything that he has to God, which exceeds you all. That's the thinking. Why Jesus calls attention to it. So what does Jesus want us to see in this story? A contrast, of course, between these two. Between two kinds of people beyond the two in this story. It jumps out when you concentrate on the tragic image of a tax collector, again in verse 13. Stood at a distance, would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast, said, God, have mercy on me, the sinner. He was a broken man. It turns out that everything that people thought about him, this tax collector, was true. And he couldn't contain it. His reputation deserved. He knew that he was a man that had a dark soul. But today, on this day, his dark soul was a rotten reality. It was a bad, bad heart. Only now it was badly broken. His words are few. I count them seven. God have mercy on me, a sinner. But his nonverbals, they tell a much bigger story, don't they? Maybe you imagine this as we went. He stood there alone as well. But he did so not in the middle, quite to the fringe, completely separated. Maybe he didn't have a seat because only special people got special seats. By design, he was to be at the sort of the Gentile far reaches of a gathering like that. He's the guy that stood aloof and he was crestfallen. We're told here, unlike the Pharisee, there's no eye contact at all. His head is down. He's broken. Guilty and self-loathing. He's stirred up and he can't hold it in. We're pretty good at that today, it seems to me. He wasn't. And Jesus draws attention to the fact by saying, he stood there at a distance and beat his breast. It's a picture the Old Testament describes of sackcloth and ashes. It's one of deep poverty, sign of a deep poverty of soul, of brokenness. In this nearly suffocating scene in this parable, the self-condemned tax collector does all he could do. The only thing he could do, cries out for mercy. God, have mercy on me. I'm a sinner. So I want you to concentrate very closely now because we have a tendency to miss the whole point of this story. In a single verse, Jesus, verse 14, stuns his listeners. He summarizes the scene in a statement that was completely 180 degrees opposite the opinion and view of people held in the day that this story is told. Let me say that again. Jesus in verse 14 makes a statement that is 180 degrees the opposite as what was expected and understood by people in the spiritual culture, religious culture of the day. Had you and I been there, well, look at verse 14, let me read it again. I tell you that this man, he's referring to the tax collector in verse 13, rather than the other, the Pharisee in verse 11, this man went home justified before God, for all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Had you been there that day, you would have wondered, did I just hear Jesus say the tax collector went home accepted by God? You would have asked somebody if you were there, did you hear what I think I heard? The answer would be, yep, you did. That's the pious. It had to be Jesus was busy with the story and got lost in it and must have reversed those. That's your thinking. Surely he meant the one that went home accepted by God was the pious Pharisee. Everybody knows that. Right? Here's the deal. And it's a problem. The problem today is that and honestly, it leaves us at risk of completely missing this story and frankly, closing our Bibles, not getting it, and not being changed by it. So I don't want that for me, and I don't want that for you. I don't. But here's the deal. Here's two reasons why we miss this story. One, first reason, write this down. We already think of Pharisees as hypocrites, don't we? I'm talking you and me now. When we think, if I ask you, what do you think of Pharisees? How many think they're amazing people? No. Some of you that know your Bibles are going to go to Matthew 23 and quote the seven woes that Jesus says, woe to you scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites. You and I know, because we're Bible students, that Pharisees are way off the mark. That's our problem. That's why we miss it. Because we know they're way off the mark. But in Jesus' day, the people of that day respected and revered Pharisees as the most pious people around. Quite in contrast, they recognize them as people that finally get it. I don't, you don't, but that Pharisee, he does. See the inverse here? But when the tax collector and not the Pharisee went home forgiven, in Jesus' words, justify. Accepted by God. When he went home that way, this let out, it's not recorded in Luke, but I guarantee you there was an audible gasp. You were in the crowd that day, it doesn't translate well in Greek, but it would have been a After all, like a lot of us still hold, good people, they're the ones that go home justified. They're the ones that go home accepted by God. Some of us live under a pile of that, believing that if I could be just good enough, I'll go home happy. Here's the second reason we risk missing Jesus' point in this parable. It's the reason I chose the title Grace. We tend today to lace grace with certain conditions like, well, if you say you're sorry, or if you show that you're trying, but Jesus is showcasing here grace that is completely, completely, completely undeserved and freely given. Nothing else is required. Remember the prostitute in Chicago? Of her and other undeserving sinners, C.S. Lewis makes this statement, and I close with it. Prostitutes are in no danger of finding their present life so satisfactory that they don't need God. It's the proud, the greedy, and the self-righteous, like the Pharisee, who live with that danger. Will you bow your heads, tuck away your notes for a moment, and I want to appeal to my fellow tax collectors and sinners this morning. Will you beat your breast and say, God, have mercy on me? I am a sinner. Will you repent of your sin and take a chance that he won't turn you away? Do that, and you may go home as surprised as the sinner in this story. God, have mercy on me, the sinner. You may go home, in fact, so surprised because you're forgiven. You'll be forgiven by him. You'll be free. And you'll be cleansed and accepted by him. And if you do, can I urge you when you leave here, don't keep it to yourself. Surprise others by what you found by coming to Jesus. Tell them the news. It's called good news for a reason. For people that are broken. For tax collectors and sinners. For the unrighteous, the unholy, the profane, the undeserving.